dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I am thrilled to say that we have with us as our first guest a man who has served his country with great distinction in, well, several phases of that war for the free world, both in the uniform of the United States Army, through the ranks of which he rose to the distinguished level of Brigadier General, as well as in his present role as a distinguished member of the House of Representatives representing the people of Pennsylvania. His name is the Honorable, literally, and Brigadier General Scott Perry, a great friend of this program, a personal friend of mine, I'm proud to say, and one of the greatest Americans in Washington, I believe, and our country is deeply indebted to him for his continuing service. And I'm delighted to have a chance to visit with him a bit about some of the challenges that our country is facing at the moment. Congressman, it's good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again.
Frank, always my grand privilege to be with you. We are personal friends, but we have a shared love for our country, and we're both on this mission to save it from the radical leftists that seek to destroy everything that is great and everything that that we cherish so much in our country. And so it's always my honor to be with you.
Amen to all of that. We're going to come back to it in a moment. But I did want to take advantage, if I could, sir, of your service in uniform, your expertise in military matters especially, your role as a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, in connection with which you were involved in interrogating the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, earlier this week, in connection with Afghanistan. And let me just ask you for the big picture, if I could, Congressman. Where do you think things went so dreadfully wrong with respect to Afghanistan? And where do we stand now in the wake of what I would describe as, a humiliating strategic defeat at Joe Biden's hands?
Yeah, it's a surrender by the president himself and the Secretary of State, and even, unfortunately, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, when I say it's a surrender by them, unfortunately, they surrendered on behalf of America, but America didn't want to surrender, and America is capable of winning every military conflict we've ever gotten into. It's not the troops or the people that wear the boots. It's always the suits that to us. And so that's one of the hardest things to take, is knowing that this didn't have to be this way, yet because we have a feckless, clueless individual at the top as the commander in chief, this is what we're left with. And Frank, at first, as it started unfolding, and we could see it coming like a slow motion train wreck. I mean, a second lieutenant right out of the academy could have seen what was going to happen, and likely did. But I first thought it was negligence, and then I thought maybe it was incompetence. But quite honestly, as it has been borne out and as it has continued, I can't help but think this was all intentional. I don't know that you could have done this more inappropriately and more to cause more damage to the United States of America than what was done over the last of the course of the last few weeks. And when you put that in the context of other things that are happening in the country, the efforts by the radical left to defund law enforcement in especially in our urban centers where crime is rampant and has been rampant, and of course the people on the lowest part of the economic spectrum, at least able to defend themselves, have to endure that. When you look at the actions on our southern border and the actions taken by the administration to literally invite unvetted, and in so many ways, when I say unvetted, not only from a security standpoint, but from a health standpoint, individuals into this country while they move to lock down the rest of American citizens. I mean, the failures of Afghanistan, I think, or the Biden policy in Afghanistan really couldn't been more more stark, more profound, had they not been planned to be done this way on purpose. And it pains me to say that, but I actually think I have a pretty strong argument. The departure from Bagram in the middle of the night without telling our counterparts, the leaving behind of $85 to $90 billion to a terrorist or to numerous terrorist organizations. What we've done is, Frank, is create, what the Biden administration has done, Americans haven't done enough. So I got to exclude yourself and myself and your listeners, what the Biden administration has done is create a terrorist super state. And we're going to suffer for this. It's just a matter of time. Not only is the Taliban running it, who provided safe harbor in the past to Al-Qaeda, Khorasan Group, ISIS, ISIS-K, et cetera. All those organizations now remain. And of course, they have the pre-weaponry on the planet in their midst. And, you know, and Secretary of State Blinken had the temerity to come to the committee last week. Well, he didn't come, as you know. He couldn't travel.
Called it in.
Blocks, Frank, to make it to the representatives of the American people to testify. Right. So but he had the temerity to tell that all that equipment is now is in disrepair. And we don't really need to be concerned about the C-130s or the top of the line UH-60 Blackhawks that were left behind, that even American aviators don't have the privilege of flying because they've got to fly older models. It is profound. It is astounding. It is unprecedented, and it is unacceptable.
Again, I want to come back to the domestic piece of this in a moment with you, but to just stay with Afghanistan for another second. You've laid out, I think, persuasively, the case that maximum damage has been inflicted, but unfortunately, the full toll that will be taken as a result is probably yet to be measured, because we're going to see this play out over time. And I'd like you nonetheless, if I could, Scott Perry, to spend a minute talking about what this defeat means for our interests, not just in Afghanistan itself, but in the region, Eurasia, more broadly, and globally, as it is going to be, addressed by not just, again, the jihadists in Afghanistan, Taliban, what have you, the Al-Qaedas, the Haqqanis, the ISIS, ISIS-Ks, and so on, but the global Islamic movement more broadly. And specifically, the response that we can anticipate to a strategic defeat at their hands for more jihad, including in our own country.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right, Frank. So when you say in our own country, let's just remember that the secretary himself admitted to me that that he's brought in this policy, this administration has brought in no less than 60,000 unvetted. And when I say unvetted, I mean, they're not in the special immigrant visa program. They've come to America to be vetted, both from a national security standpoint, from a health standpoint. They're in America right now. We already have credible reports from the administration that they have picked up bad actors, and that would be the likes of Al-Qaeda, ISIS-K, Khorasan, you name it, in that population. And they're housed, they're being staged at military bases around the United States. And we also know, according to the secretary's testimony, that they're free to leave at any time, including right now, Frank, while they're not vetted. So if you're a terrorist who's made his way to the great Satan, and now you're here, why are you going to stick around to be vetted and maybe found out and be expelled? You're going to leave the camp, the military base, and you're going to be out in America doing whatever you're going to do. So that's front and center. But on a macro scale, of course, we've lost. They're on the loose. We've lost on a macro scale. We've lost our ability for reconnaissance, intelligence, surveillance, ISR is what we call it, from that region, because Afghanistan was our base to watch China, to watch Iran, to watch Pakistan, to watch Russia. That's all gone now. And this over-the-horizon stuff is meaningless. And I'll just, look, you don't have to count on Scott Perry to tell you that. The over-the-horizon stuff, well, we didn't even use that when we droned a person that was actually friendly to the American plight, to the American cause. We droned him when we were in country. So what do you think the intelligence is going to be when we're not in country and we've got to fly from Whiteman Air Force Base or closest maybe Qatar or something like that? What do you think when people say this, we have this over-the-horizon reach? The over-horizon reach is worthless without eyes on and without targeting. And then, Frank, as you know, we've got our ally in Taiwan who now daily has to suffer the barrage of the Communist Party of China saying, look, America abandoned Afghanistan, Taiwan, and they're going to abandon you too. Our enemies don't respect us at all, and our allies don't trust us any longer. It is a horrific circumstances that have been created unnecessarily by this administration.
And they're fraught with peril, I think is the bottom line. Emboldened adversaries, undermined allies is almost certainly going to conduce to more enemies and fewer friends and more danger for Americans, not just elsewhere around the world, but here at home. I've got so much more to talk with you about. We're going to run out of time before we get to most of it. But just very quickly, a few words on China. You've talked about them in the context of this defeat in Afghanistan and the prospect of coming threats to Taiwan. How would you characterize them? We're told that General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff back in 2015, did not consider them to be an enemy. I don't know if he does today or not. We'll talk more about him in a minute. But do you? And if they are, how fully engaged are they in what they have described as unrestricted warfare against this country, sir?
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. And of course, we did hear these words from General Milley. The problem with this is that while General Milley and even Americans, whether they're involved in the defense of the country or not, China considers us an enemy. And they have said so. And they have said so in the book and the plan, the game plan, the war plan, unrestricted warfare. And you know, we would be remiss in this conversation at this time talking about the Communist Party of China. And let's be clear, Frank, we're talking about the Communist Party of China. There are probably untold billions of Chinese that would love to have their freedom, but they live under the totalitarian boot of these communist thugs. But the fact that General Milley considers his counterpart in the Chinese Communist Party well enough to call him in advance of what he might have thought was provocative actions because of exercises in and around China conducted by the United States military in international waters is gravely concerning. And I tell you that, Frank, not because you don't know it, because many of your listeners might not understand the depth and the gravity of the rot that is occurring in the government, not only in this administration. And we could spend probably hours talking about the members of this administration who have very strong connections to China, but now the military, you're seeing it up close and personal. This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who is kowtowing and doing the bidding of the Communist Party of China, who considers the United States an enemy. If there is not a 15-6 investigation, if there are not Senate hearings into this, and if this is any way true, if there is not the dismissal with extreme prejudice of General Milley, it's yet one more travesty foisted upon the American people against their will that imperils the United States at the hands of the Communist Party of China.
You are a member in your role as a retired Brigadier General in the United States Army National Guard, Scott, of a group that I'm very impressed by, Flag Officers for America. And that group has called for the resignation of General Milley. In fact, they called for it before this latest revelation about his conversations with the Chinese Communist Party's top general officer, General Li. When you talk about a 15-6 investigation, what specifically does that mean to the layperson, and what would the implications of it be to bring to an end what seems to be an increasingly problematic record of America's top General.
You're absolutely right, Frank. Look, I've been calling for Milley's resignation for years now as incompetent and not a leader of sorts of any stretch of the imagination, and to let people know he does not sit in the chain of command at all. So, you know, you need to think of that in the context of the things that he has allegedly said. But that all aside, the 15-6 is the code. It's the manual. It's actually the Army regulation. It's AR, Army Regulation 15-6. And it is the method by which officers and individuals under the Uniform Code of Military Justice receive due process for allegations against them. So, again, I say if these allegations are true, but we're not going to know that, right? There's only one way to know that is to have an investigation. And so the American people are due the truth, and General Milley is due process. And then the only way to get it without partisanship, or at least a modicum of less partisanship, is to have the military conduct this investigation. It would have to be by an officer of equal or greater rank. Of course, there are none of greater rank, but there are officers of equal rank, and investigate this, find out if this indeed did happen. And if it did indeed happen, Frank, then they would make a recommendation of whether a court-martial was in order or a dismissal or something along those lines. But I would just caveat it with this, and it is important to say that if true, and if substantiated and the findings are such in an AR-15-6 investigation that these things were indeed occurred as the book has said, and these things were said to the military leader of the Communist Chinese Party, this is treasonous activity and deserves all the punishments that come with treasonous activity.
I want to take your point, sir, about if proven true. I am struck, however, by the absence of any refutation by the general of these charges. I mean, his spokesman trotted out kind of a spin saying, well...
Yeah, he hasn't denied...
That tells you something, and I think we ought to proceed on the basis that this is... There's truth here somewhere.
Yeah, he hasn't denied it at all. As a matter of fact, he said he made the calls, and of course, we also know now that those calls were not approved, they were not sanctioned, and the acting Secretary of Defense at the time had no idea the calls were being made. So I think that, you know, there absolutely needs to be an investigation. I think that it's fine and it's appropriate for the general to come in and face the Senate's Armed Services Committee, the House Armed Services Committee, but that does not go nearly enough. There needs to be an investigation, which quite ironically, as you know, Frank, also include the speaker herself, because according to the report, General Milley had a conversation with her, which politicized the national security of the United States of America, which does not violate the standard. Well, it violates the standards of conduct for sure. It might not violate the law, but it certainly violates the standards of conduct for officers and for which he would be relieved.
Which brings me to the last point, sir. You've talked about what is the ambition of the radical left in this country to take it down. I personally very strongly agree with your assessment that we're not witnessing incompetence or, you know, plain malfeasance. We're talking about people who are deliberately trying to do maximum damage. And as you say, it's across the board. It's not just Afghanistan. It's not just the borders. It's not just COVID. It's our educational system. It's critical race theory. It's taking down the military, on and on and on. To what end, sir, are they proceeding?
Look, they are pursuing their socialist utopia. And as often the case, while socialism has failed literally every single time it's been tried, since it's ever been tried anywhere on the globe, they always feel like, but it'll end up the same way. But that's what they're seeking. And what can American citizens do? Look, we are in a tough spot right now because these elections have consequences. Even if people did the right thing, went out and voted the right way, it didn't turn out this way. And so we're stuck with this circumstance with what we have. The important thing is that they back up their Republican office holders where they should, those who are defending the Constitution and America. And for those who seem a little bit less fortitude or less of a strong spine, to hold them to account. And certainly on the Democrat side, to make sure that they feel uncomfortable about the dismantling of the country that that you love and cherish. And we need to understand that this is a different time. This isn't the politics or the Democrat Party of 40 or 50 years ago. They keep the name because it has credibility.
Congressman Scott Perry, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your joining us again. And, you know, the courage with which you take on these fights, just as you did those in combat in the uniform of the United States Army. Your service to our country, past, present, and future, is so appreciated. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir. Next up, we'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Lance Crayon. He is a man who's had very interesting career, including some stints working for Chinese communist propaganda arms, notably China Radio, China Daily, and Global Times. These days, he is back in the United States, and he is working as an investigative journalist and a consultant on China matters. And we are always happy to consult with him, particularly about what I think he's developed a real expertise concerning, and it ought to be very much part of our mindset when it comes to the Chinese unrestricted warfare program, namely their information operations and their bids to dominate the information battle space. Lance Crayon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
There are reports, and I know you follow Hollywood very closely, and you've been warning for some time about what the Chinese are doing there. But the latest information that I'm getting is that the Chinese are now essentially pulling out of Hollywood, distancing themselves from it, and greatly traumatizing people who own studios and make films and otherwise are part of that ecosystem, who have come to really depend upon China, specifically putting their films into the vast Chinese market to make their business profitable. Talk about what's going on, Lance, and why.
But, you know, for the first time ever last year, the top 10 films in China were all Chinese productions. For the first time ever, usually America holds at least 5 of those positions, if not more. So the transition is that China is becoming more self-reliant, whereas Hollywood has always, for the past seven years, relied on the Chinese market. So they're being pushed out.
Do you believe that what China was doing during those past 7 years, or perhaps a little even before that, was what they have done in industry after industry after industry in this country? Namely, they've kind of moved in, they have expropriated through outright theft or purchase intellectual property and technology and know-how. And then inexorably, they supplant the American firms or operations with their own and essentially seek to hollow out and destroy what they have been using as kind of a host organism for the previous period.
That's kind of their modus operandi. I mean, that's what they've done in other industries. And here we see it happening in Hollywood. They moved in. Hollywood became reliant on Chinese money, and now they're pulling the stakes up. So what, you know, and at the same time, Hollywood has transitioned and adjusted itself to where it answers. It's gotten used to answering to China for the opportunity to have those films, to have their films play in China. Well, it's still going to kowtow to China, but there's no guarantee that the films will play.
When you say that they have accommodated themselves to China, what do you mean by that in terms of content?
Yeah, in terms of content, what they do is they kowtow to Chinese censors. So they make films that will appease China, follow China rules, follow China censors, for the chance of playing on the mainland. There's still no guarantee, which is scary, because it's like you make the film and then we'll watch it and then we'll decide. And even if we decide to play it, we could pull up, we could change our minds in the last minute, which is what happened with the film over the summer, Black Widow. Black Widow was scheduled to play in China, and then at the last minute they said, no, it's not going to play in China.
And what has been the implication of that for the filmmakers involved?
I mean, it's it's a huge, it's a gamble. It's a money loss. It's you work for us regardless of what we do with your films.
And
so there's no guarantee.
If a film like Black Widow, for example, can't play in China, what does that likely translate into the bottom line?
In terms of money, I mean, that would have been, you know, easily $100 million, $150 million right there lost.
Now, again, the thing that I value so much about your insights into all of this, Lance, is you have a deep knowledge of how the Chinese are thinking and what the, you know, sort of agenda behind these kinds of activities. If I understand what you're saying correctly, China has now gotten itself into a position whereby they can essentially control the content that Americans are going to see, whether they allow Chinese to see any of the products or not. And if the Chinese decide, maybe even at the last moment, not to allow you to have access to the Chinese market, they can presumably bankrupt a film operation. Could they not?
That's exactly right. Without the way China has it set up now, they control not just what America sees, but really what the world sees. I mean, Hollywood's always been the premier source of films, and also television scripted dramas, because of streaming platforms, people all over the world will watch American shows. So China's grip on Hollywood controls what you watch, regardless of where you are. So it's not just an America China relationship. This is a global concern.
Is China now making films for the export market as well, or are they principally just focusing on their domestic one?
Domestic. There's no demand for Chinese films outside of mainland China for the simple fact that they're not very good. They don't screen anywhere else. They don't open in theaters in Vietnam or in France or India, because, again, there's no demand. They're not very good.
But so, again, this makes all the more insidious what they've been doing in terms of content control of American films. If those films are the only ones that are going to be seen as a practical matter, the dominant ones, at least worldwide, if they're able to make sure that they toe essentially the party line, they will be influencing the world, not just American audiences. Talk a little bit about this film Dune and what has been going on with that. Another expected major, you know, film, you know, bonanza for the box office. But is it going to be based on what the Chinese are up to now?
It's supposed to be. And that's what's scary, because here it is. It's September 17th. There's no release date for the film. And it's in China. Right. It already opened in Taiwan. It already opened in Europe on Wednesday. It's supposed to open October 1st during the Chinese national holiday, Autumn Festival holiday, but they have not confirmed that. So, and who does that? I mean, usually a film of this magnitude, the budget is $175 million. China put up 75% of the money to make the film to begin with. But as a partner, as a film partner, usually a film of that magnitude will have a release date set in stone, you know, 4 months out, if not longer. And it's supposed to play in 2 weeks. We don't know yet. I mean, I think that's a really bad way of doing business.
And two questions, I guess. One, why would they be doing that to their own production, basically? And what are the implications of not having a release date 2 weeks from, you know, when it's supposed to launch?
I think number one, it's a power play. It's just keeping America on ice, so American film, Hollywood on ice, a control issue. And here's a theory I have, and it's really, of course, just a theory, but the only Asian actor in the film Dune is from Taiwan. His name is Zhang Chen. Now, 2 weeks ago, there was a Taiwanese actor who was canceled in mainland China. She was one of the most, she's the highest paid Taiwanese actress, because she used the words my country in a thesis she wrote 10 years ago. I mean, talk about nitpicking, right? So they considered that to be, you know, anti-China, because she referred to Taiwan as her country, again, in a thesis she wrote in college 10 years ago. So this actor, Zhang Chen, I wouldn't be surprised, again, just to guess, if they're looking for something on him that says or suggests, you know, he's anti-China and pro-Taiwan, so they can cancel the film. Now, that would make sense, but they've done things that do not make sense just to confuse or thwart Hollywood. I mean,
Hollywood, in point of fact.
Sure.
And that, again, sure. I guess is what I'm trying to get at, Lance, is if you look at this strategically from China's point of view, and they generally do look at things strategically, to the extent that they're able not only to effectively control the output of this global phenomenon of Hollywood, influencing what Americans see, yes, but also what the rest of the world does, and they can exercise increasing dominion over it, it seems to me it's a matter of time before they are, in fact, trying to make films that will be Chinese films for foreign markets as well, and really, you know, supplant Hollywood. That may be sometime down the road and so on, but to the extent that Hollywood increasingly works for China, it would fit, again, as you say, Lance, the pattern of automobiles and electronic goods and all kinds of other things that they've essentially hollowed out, expropriated, and destroyed, you know, those foreign competitors. Quickly, and sort of a related point on this Taiwan business, you know, we're watching very closely the increasing threats to Taiwan from China, and what seems to be an increasing preparedness on the part of the Chinese to actually use violence to try to obtain, you know, physical control of that island. What are they doing in the Vienna Film Festival and its virtual counterpart, I guess, here in Portland, is another example of this kind of inexorable pressure and effort to dominate Taiwan?
Recently at the Venice Film Festival, they have a program, a virtual reality program, and all Taiwanese productions were referred to as Taipei, being from Taipei instead of Taiwan. Really, China's Taipei, then they changed that to Taipei, and then in parentheses it said, as per institutional practices, which I have no idea what that means. I've never seen that before. So like a co-production, for example, from France and Taiwan would say France and Taipei. Now, the same program, this virtual
Taipei,
reality
of course,
program,
being the capital of Taiwan, but a city, not the whole island.
Right. They were trying to scrub the name Taiwan out of really just everything, off of everything, you name it. They don't want to see the word Taiwan anywhere, okay? So Venice Film Festival has the program screening right now at the Portland Film Festival, at the Portland Art Museum. And Portland Art Museum kowtowed to those demands as well. If you look at their program right now, and it says Taipei, the word Taiwan does not appear anywhere near. Here's what's interesting. Last year, they had the same program, and Taiwan is listed all over it. Not a problem. And they even changed smaller details about where the films were made. A Taiwanese production last year, now it says it was a mainland production. I reached out to them. They didn't respond. I reached out for a comment. I mean, I'm talking about minuscule changes, edits that weren't in place last year are in place now with an American institution. I mean, the Portland Art Museum is the seventh largest or seventh oldest art museum in America.
Well, again, I guess what it comes down to is domination and control and increasingly, presumably, psychological pressure on warfare against Taiwan, its people, its government. And its will to resist China. I think that's clearly where the Chinese are at the moment, is Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese strategist of several millennia ago, made the point that it's better to win without fighting if you can. That's clearly the Chinese preference, but the concern is that they may be preparing for it just the same. But in the meantime, seeing what they can do to persuade the Taiwanese to simply submit to them. So we'll be watching this closely, Lance. Karyanite, very, very important part of the battle space of China and its unrestricted warfare against us and the rest of the world. We appreciate your insights into it and look forward to visiting with you more about all of this soon. In the meantime, Stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Wayne Allen Root. We'll talk with him about China and its economic warfare against the United States and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined once again by a personal friend of mine and a man who has distinguished himself both in service to his own nation of Peru and as a champion for freedom and free enterprise and for international security on the global stage, notably in his previous roles as the Minister for Agriculture and Fisheries and also as the Finance Minister of Peru. His name is Ismael Benavides. He is joining us from Peru as we speak, and I want to thank him very much for both taking the time to talk with us and for his courage in speaking so forthrightly about a danger that is now upon Peru and that has very ominous implications for the region of South America, and I think for us further north in this hemisphere and indeed the world itself. Ismael, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to talk to you and to your audience in Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. Let me talk to you first about something that we spoke about, a month and a half or so ago, I guess, namely the election that took place that resulted in a president being sworn into office who is tied to a terrorist organization through his party. That would be the Shining Path, that has wrought great harm to the people of Peru in the past and seems to be coming back now under his, leadership, if you will, or at least in his name. Give us a sense of what is afoot there at the moment with Pedro Castillo and his party and the election outcome as it stands now.
Yes, the elections, the runoff took place in June 9th. And the election was rigged in favor of this extremist party called Peru Libre, Peru Free Peru in English. And it was won by a minimum margin through a widespread fraud, which was denounced at the time, but the electoral board gave no hearing to those accusations, and furthermore the OAS did not intervene as has been the case in Bolivia and other elections. So this fellow Pedro Castillo, who's an extremist, was elected, and he took office on July 28th. He appointed a new cabinet, which was of the 16 ministers, 12 are extremists, leftists. Some of them are related closely to the Shining Path terrorist movement, and
I understand at least one of them is actually a Shining Path terrorist himself. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. The labor minister. He's been accused of participating in numerous terrorist acts, bombing public offices and attacking churches and that sort of thing. So we're faced with these violent people. Shining Path has sort of mutated from an armed organization to a pretense of a political party, and they have taken over part of the teachers' union, and which was never recognized until this government. And so there's been this huge discussion of all these terrorist-linked ministers, plus all the incompetent people the government has appointed, because they are not only terrorists, but incompetent. And
if they were incompetent terrorists, it wouldn't be such a problem, I suppose. But I'm afraid they're probably too competent at the terrorism and maybe incompetent at governance. But the point here is, as I understand it, Ismail, that first of all, it looks as though it was a fraudulent election. Second of all, there was no help forthcoming from the United States, the Biden administration, or other international partners to stave off what is now afoot. And your worst fears are being realized, it sounds like, with this regime tied to, if not basically the front men for, a terrorist organization with narco-terrorist ties and just plain old-fashioned Marxist revolutionary attributes. Now, in charge of the government of a very important country in South America. And for many in our audience, I think it's not probably clear just how important your country is in the region and, well, for us here in the United States as well. So take a minute, if you would, Ismail Benavides, and talk about the implications, again, both for the hemisphere and for our country, if these folks have their way in Peru.
Yes, well, the impact can be huge, and they're not only a local movement, but they are supported by what is called the Sao Paulo Forum, where you have a list of all the extremist parties in Latin America, plus Cuba, plus Venezuela, plus Bolivia, and all the extremist leftist party in and finally, Mexico is actually supporting this government also. Mr. López Obrador, who we know is leftist, but not as extremist. But in any case, they give vocal support to this sort of government. And
in fact, Castillo is headed to Mexico today, I think, is he not?
Exactly, exactly. He's headed for a meeting of CELAC, which is an organism that was created by the Cubans to sort of try to influence in economic policies in the region.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong with that? The Cubans, for heaven's sake.
Exactly.
So he's headed as well to the United Nations, as I understand it, to make his inaugural address up there. We can expect to see him wearing his oversized hat up on the stage, I expect. But more to the point, is he now signaling with clarity what his agenda is? Is it really right out of the Cuban or Nicaraguan or Venezuelan Marxist playbook, Ismail?
Well, right now we're not in the execution stage. I call it the they're trying to lull us to a false sense of security while they build up their takeover of the government and come up with their and start executing the leftist plan, which we know how it is. I mean, they start out with a change in the constitution, which not only limits private enterprise and all the personal freedom of people, but plus they set the stage to re-elect themselves and stay in power as long as they can, just like the Cubans, just like Maduro and Chavez in Venezuela. So that's their first stage. Then the second stage is to begin to distribute subsidies to the people. They have been, in a sense, lucky that all our commodity prices are very high, so they have big tax revenues, and so they're going to splurge it all in subsidies and that sort of thing. And then become more interventionist in the economy with labor issues, with other restrictions, controls, exchange controls. So it's a process that we've seen happen across the continent whenever these sort of governments come in. But
confiscatory is one of the terms that comes to mind of whether it's nationalizing or simply redistributing the wealth, as they're fond of calling it.
Exactly.
Are you seeing this, which,
as in Venezuela, that was a rich country, has ended up with over 90% poverty. No, and that's a route that these governments take. They have this rich, filthy rich elite that does whatever it wants with the government, and then they have all the poor people in their pocket because they give out subsidies, they give out ration, food stamps, food cards, and the government is the only one that is able to do that. So,
but if they don't have them in their pocket, they've got them under their jackboot, I think it's fair to say, as we've seen in Venezuela. And this brings me to the question that I wanted to come back to with you, Ismael, because if this playbook is followed faithfully, and I gather that, you know, they are moving forward on the execution phase of this process, then you will probably see, as elsewhere in the hemisphere, large numbers of Peruvians leaving the country, which will result in, quite likely, some number of them coming to other countries which may not be able to sustain them, and inevitably coming here as well. Is that not likely?
5 million Venezuelans have left their country because of the situation there. And so Peru, which is a country of similar size, could probably have the same amount of migrants. And so it would pose a problem for the U.S. I mean, if you right now have a problem of illegal immigration, this will be increased substantially by a large inflow of Peruvian emigres fleeing communism.
Yeah, and there's no question that most of us feel that we do have a problem with the border at the moment, let alone if there were another 5 million people headed our way. So one other piece of this, which is also of direct relevance to our own interests, we've talked a little bit about before with you, Ismael Benavides, is the likelihood that these terrorists and the narco traffickers with whom they associate will greatly increase the production of, well, cocaine or other drugs that will wind up coming to our country as well. Is that right? And give us a sense of the scale that might reach.
Well, that's a major problem because right now Peru is the second largest producer of cocaine in the world after Colombia. But not only that, they're beginning to produce opium here. And so the Mexican, Colombian, and other cartels are busy in Peru. And Shining Path is closely associated to the narcotics traders and producers. And so what we will see is an increase in the production of cocaine, plus this government, particularly the extremist people in it, want to kick out the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency of the U.S., which has been helping controlling the cocaine trade in Peru. So I imagine that will end up in a major production increase of cocaine, which obviously part of it will go to the U.S.
Which will translate into more overdoses, more deaths, more harm to our society as well. So we have, in short, a very real stake in what is playing out at the moment in your country, Peru. And what are the chances that this will be redressed? Is there any prospect at the moment that this seeming imminent communist Marxist revolutionary takeover of this vital country is not going to materialize?
Well, Before I address your question, Frank, I would like to say that also we are seeing an increase in the Chinese influence, not only through their investments in Peru, and they're right now Peru's major trading partner because they buy most of our copper, iron ore, and other minerals. They are beginning to be much more active and looking at doing more investments.
Bring more
and
of
also,
a presence.
Funnily enough, the Russians have offered the government to set up a manufacturing plant for their Sputnik vaccine against COVID-19. And that, I think, is first of all, is technically ridiculous. I mean,
not a very good vaccine.
Technology is not up to standards. So I think they're trying to displace the U.S., obviously, through Peru and also in the region.
And Hezbollah and Iran and on and on. Yeah. But just very quickly, what can we do at this point, if anything, to help?
Well, I think the U.S. Should maintain a strong presence in Peru. I think they should not fall into the trap of being aggressive. I mean, they're trying to. I think they should try to be closer to the government. They recently signed a $300 million aid package with USAID. So, I mean, it's not all, lost in the relation with the U.S. We have a free trade agreement and so on. So I think because there is a strong rift within the government between the extremists and the less extreme, I think the U.S. Should try to support those less extremists in the cabinet, particularly, and try to, through them, be a closer influence with the president. The president is a very ignorant person, and I think he can be swayed with the right arguments and the right signals.
This will be very interesting to see.
So,
Ismail, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I want to come back to you on particularly what sorts of steps might be taken to sway him to a more sensible policy approach and whether it can be done given the dominance of this Shining Path Peru Libre policy party now operating, it seems, somewhat in the superior position to him. We'll talk with you about that and more, I hope, in the very near future. Thanks for joining us today. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.